New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Part 1, Chapter 5 of A Brief History of English and American Literature. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Kalinda. A Brief History of English and American Literature by Henry A. Beers. Part 1, Chapter 5. From the Restoration to the Death of Pope, 1660 to 1744. The Stuart Restoration was a period of descent from poetry to prose, from passion and imagination to wit and understanding. The serious, exalted mood of the Civil War and the Commonwealth had spent itself and issued in disillusion. There followed a generation of wits, logical, skeptical, and prosaic, without earnestness as without principle. The characteristic literature of such a time is criticism, satire, and burlesque. And such, indeed, continued to be the course of English literary history for a century after the return of the Stuarts. The age was not a stupid one, but one of active inquiry. The Royal Society for the Cultivation of the Natural Sciences was founded in 1662. There were able divines in the pulpit and at the university, Barrow, Tillotson, Stillingfleet, South, and others, scholars like Bentley, historians like Clarendon and Burnet, scientists like Boyle and Newton, philosophers like Hobbes and Locke. But of poetry, in any high sense of the word, there was little between the time of Milton and the time of Goldsmith and Gray. The English writers of this period were strongly influenced by the contemporary literature of France, by the comedies of Molière and the tragedies of Corneille and Racine, and the satires, epistles, and versified essays of Boileau. Many of the Restoration writers, Waller, Cowley, Davenant, Wycherley, Villiers, and others, had been in France during the exile, and brought back with them French tastes. John Dryden, 1631 to 1700, who is the great literary figure of his generation, has been called the first of the moderns. From the reign of Charles II, indeed, we may date the beginnings of modern English life. What we call society was forming, the town, the London world. Coffee, which makes the politician wise, had just been introduced, and the ordinaries of Ben Jonson's time gave way to coffee houses, like Wills and Buttons, which became the headquarters of literary and political gossip. The two great English parties as we know them today were organized. The words Whig and Tory date from this reign. French etiquette and fashions came in, and French phrases of convenience, such as coup de grâce, bel esprit, etc., began to appear in English prose. Literature became intensely urban and partisan. It reflected city life, the disputes of faction, and the personal quarrels of authors. The politics of the Great Rebellion had been of heroic proportions and found fitting expression in song, but in the Revolution of 1688, the issues were constitutional and to be settled by the arguments of lawyers. Measures were in question rather than principles, and there was little inspiration to the poet in exclusion bills and acts of settlement. Court and society, in the reign of Charles II and James II, were shockingly dissolute, and in literature, as in life, the reaction against Puritanism went to great extremes. The social life of the time is faithfully reflected in the Diary of Samuel Pepys. He was a simple-minded man, the son of a London tailor, and became himself secretary to the Admiralty. His diary was kept in cipher and published only in 1825. Being written for his own eye, it is singularly outspoken, and its naive, gossipy, confidential tone makes it a most diverting book, as it is historically a most valuable one. Perhaps the most popular book of its time was Samuel Butler's Hudibras, 1663-64, a burlesque romance in ridicule of the Puritans. The king carried a copy of it in his pocket, and Pepys testifies that it was quoted and praised on all sides. Ridicule of the Puritans was nothing new. Zeal of the Land Busy, in Ben Jonson's Bartholomew Fair, is an early instance of the kind. There was nothing laughable about the earnestness of men like Cromwell, Milton, Algernon Sidney, and Sir Henry Vane, but even the French Revolution had its humors, and as the English Puritan Revolution gathered head and the extremer sectaries pressed to the front, Quakers, New Lights, Fifth Monarchy men, ranters, etc., its grotesque sides came uppermost. Butler's hero is a Presbyterian justice of the peace, who sallies forth with his secretary Ralpho, an Independent and Anabaptist, like Don Quixote with Sancho Panza, to suppress May games and bear baitings. Macaulay, it will be remembered, said that the Puritans disapproved of bear baiting, not because it gave pain to the bear, but because it gave pleasure to the spectators. The humor of Hudibras is not of the finest. The knight and squire are discomfited in broadly comic adventures, hardly removed from the rough, physical drolleries of a pantomime or a circus. The deep heart laughter of Cervantes, the pathos on which his humor rests, is of course not to be looked for in Butler. But he had a wit of a sharp, logical kind, and his style surprises with all manner of verbal antics. He is almost as great a phrase maker as Pope, though in a coarser kind. His verse is a smart doggerel, and his poem has furnished many stock sayings, as, for example, "'Tis strange what difference there can be twixt Tweedledum and Tweedledee." Hudibras had many imitators, not the least successful of whom was the American John Trumbull in his revolutionary satire M'Fingal, some couplets of which are generally quoted as Butler's, as, for example, "No man e'er felt the halter draw with good opinion of the law." The rebound against Puritanism is seen no less plainly in the drama of the Restoration, and the stage now took vengeance for its enforced silence under the Protectorate. Two theaters were opened under the patronage, respectively, of the king and of his brother, the Duke of York. The manager of the latter, Sir William Davenant, who had fought on the king's side, been knighted for his services, escaped to France, and was afterward captured and imprisoned in England for 2 years, had managed to evade the law against stage plays as early as 1656 by presenting his Siege of Rhodes as an opera, with instrumental music and dialogue in recitative, after a fashion newly sprung up in Italy. This he brought out again in 1661, with the dialogue recast into rhyming couplets in the French fashion. Movable painted scenery was now introduced from France, and actresses took the female parts formerly played by boys. This last innovation was said to be at the request of the king, one of whose mistresses, the famous Nell Gwynn, was the favorite actress at the King's Theatre. Upon the stage thus reconstructed, the so-called classical rules of the French theatre were followed, at least in theory. The Louis XIV writers were not purely creative like Shakespeare and his contemporaries in England, but critical and self-conscious. The Academy had been formed in 1636 for the preservation of the purity of the French language, and discussion abounded on the principles and methods of literary art. Corneille not only wrote tragedies, but essays on tragedy, and one in particular on the Three Unities. Dryden followed his example in his Essay of Dramatic Poesy, in which he treated of the unities and argued for the use of rhyme in tragedy in preference to blank verse. His own practice varied. Most of his tragedies were written in rhyme, but in the best of them, All for Love, 1678, founded on Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, he returned to blank verse. One of the principles of the classical school was to keep comedy and tragedy distinct. The tragic dramatists of the Restoration, Dryden, Howard, Settle, Crowne, Lee, and others, composed what they called heroic plays, such as The Indian Emperor, The Conquest of Granada, The Duke of Lerma, The Empress of Morocco, The Destruction of Jerusalem, Nero, and The Rival Queens. The titles of these pieces indicate their character. Their heroes were great historic personages. Subject and treatment were alike remote from nature and real life. The diction was stilted and artificial, and pompous declamation took the place of action and genuine passion. The tragedies of Racine seemed chill to an Englishman brought up on Shakespeare. But to see how great an artist Racine was, in his own somewhat narrow way, one has but to compare his Phèdre, or Iphigénie, with Dryden's ranting tragedy of tyrannic love. These bombastic heroic plays were made the subject of a capital burlesque, The Rehearsal, by George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, acted in 1671 at the King's Theatre. The indebtedness of the English stage to the French did not stop with a general adoption of its dramatic methods, but extended to direct imitation and translation. Dryden's comedy, An Evening's Love, was adapted from Thomas Corneille's Le Fin Astrologue, and his Sir Martin Maral from Molière's L'Étourdi. Shadwell borrowed his Miser from Molière, and Otway made versions of Racine's Bérénice and Molière's Fourberie de Scapin. Wycherley's Country Wife and Plain Dealer, although not translations, were based, in a sense, upon Molière's École des Femmes and Le Misanthrope. The only one of the tragic dramatists of the Restoration who prolonged the traditions of the Elizabethan stage was Otway, whose Venice Preserved, written in blank verse, still keeps the boards. There are fine passages in Dryden's heroic plays, passages weighty in thought and nobly sonorous in language. There is one great scene between Antony and Ventidius in his All for Love, and one at least of his comedies, The Spanish Friar, is skillfully constructed. But his nature was not pliable enough for the drama, and he acknowledged that in writing for the stage, he forced his genius. In sharp contrast with these heroic plays was the comic drama of the Restoration. The plays of Wycherley, Killigrew, Etherege, Farquhar, Vanbrugh, Congreve, and others, plays like The Country Wife, The Parson's Wedding, She Would If She Could, The Beau's Stratagem, The Relapse, and The Way of the World. These were in prose, and represented the gay world and the surface of fashionable life. Amorous intrigue was their constantly recurring theme. Some of them were written expressly in ridicule of the Puritans. Such was the Committee of Dryden's brother-in-law, Sir Robert Howard, the hero of which is a distressed gentleman, and the villain, a London cit, and president of the committee appointed by Parliament to sit upon the sequestration of the estates of royalists. Such were also the Roundheads and the Banished Cavaliers of Mrs. Aphra Behn, who was a female spy in the service of Charles II at Antwerp, and one of the coarsest of the Restoration comedians. The profession of piety had become so disagreeable that a shameless cynicism was now considered the mark of a gentleman. The ideal hero of Wycherley or Etherege was the witty young profligate who had seen life and learned to disbelieve in virtue. His highest qualities were a contempt for cant, physical courage, a sort of spendthrift generosity, and a good-natured readiness to back up a friend in a quarrel or an amour. Virtue was bourgeois, reserved for London tradespeople. A man must be either a rake or a hypocrite. The gentlemen were rakes, the city people were hypocrites. Their wives, however, were all in love with the gentlemen, and it was the proper thing to seduce them and to borrow their husbands' money. For the first and last time, perhaps, in the history of the English drama, the sympathy of the audience was deliberately sought for the seducer and the rogue, and the laugh turned against the dishonored husband and the honest man. Contrast this with Shakespeare's Merry Wives of Windsor. The women were represented as worse than the men, scheming, ignorant, and corrupt. The dialogue in the best of these plays was easy, lively, and witty. The situations in some of them audacious almost beyond belief. Under a thin varnish of good breeding, the sentiments and manners were really brutal. The loosest gallants of Beaumont and Fletcher's theatre retain a fineness of feeling and that politesse de coeur which marks the gentleman. They are poetic creatures and own a capacity for romantic passion. But the Manleys and Homers of the Restoration comedy have a prosaic, cold-blooded profligacy that disgusts. Charles Lamb, in his ingenious essay on the artificial comedy of the last century, apologized for the Restoration stage, on the ground that it represented a world of whim and unreality in which the ordinary laws of morality had no application. But Macaulay answered truly that at no time has the stage been closer in its imitation of real life. The theater of Wycherley and Etherege was but the counterpart of that social condition which we read of in Pepys's diary and in the memoirs of the Chevalier de Grammont. This prose comedy of manners was not, indeed, artificial at all, in the sense in which the contemporary tragedy, the heroic play, was artificial. It was, on the contrary, far more natural, and intellectually, of much higher value. In 1698, Jeremy Collier, a non-juring Jacobite clergyman, published his Short View of the Immorality and Profaneness of the English Stage, which did much toward reforming the practice of the dramatists. The formal characteristics, without the immorality, of the Restoration comedy reappeared briefly in Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer, 1772, and Sheridan's Rival, School for Scandal, and Critic, 1775-79. are last strictly classical comedies. None of this school of English comedians approached their model Molière. He excelled his imitators not only in his French urbanity, the polished wit and delicate grace of his style, but in the dexterous unfolding of his plot, and in the wisdom and truth of his criticism of life, and his insight into character. It is a symptom of the false taste of the age that Shakespeare's plays were rewritten for the Restoration stage. Davenant made new versions of Macbeth and Julius Caesar, substituting rhyme for blank verse. In conjunction with Dryden, he altered The Tempest, complicating the intrigue by the introduction of a male counterpart to Miranda, a youth who had never seen a woman. Shadwell improved Timon of Athens, and Nahum Tate furnished a new fifth act to King Lear, which turned the play into a comedy. In the prologue to his doctored version of Troilus and Cressida, Dryden made the ghost of Shakespeare speak of himself as untaught, unpracticed in a barbarous age. Thomas Rymer, whom Pope pronounced a good critic, was very severe upon Shakespeare in his Remarks on the Tragedies of the Last Age, and in his Short View of Tragedy, 1693. He said, "In the neighing of a horse or in the growling of a mastiff, there is more humanity than, many times, in the tragical flights of Shakespeare." "To Deptford by water," writes Pepys in his diary for August 20, 1666, "reading Othello, Moor of Venice, which I ever heretofore esteemed a mighty good play, but having so lately read The Adventures of 5 Hours, it seems a mean thing." In undramatic poetry, the new school, both in England and in France, took its point of departure in a reform against the extravagances of the Marinists, or conceited poets, specially represented in England by Donne and Cowley. The new poets, both in their theory and practice, insisted upon correctness, clearness, polish, moderation, and good sense. Boileau's L'Art Poétique, 1673, inspired by Horace's Ars Poetica, was a treatise in verse upon the rules of correct composition, and it gave the law in criticism for over a century, not only in France, but in Germany and England. It gave English poetry a didactic turn, and started the fashion of writing critical essays in rhyming couplets. The Earl of Mulgrave published 2 poems of this kind, an essay on satire and an essay on poetry. The Earl of Roscommon, who, said Addison, makes even rules a noble poetry, made a metrical version of Horace's Ars Poetica, and wrote an original essay on translated verse. Of the same kind were Addison's epistle to Sacheverell, entitled An Account of the Greatest English Poets, and Pope's Essay on Criticism, 1711, which was nothing more than versified maxims of rhetoric, put with Pope's usual point and brilliancy. The classicism of the 18th century, it has been said, was a classicism in red heels and a periwig. It was Latin rather than Greek. It turned to the least imaginative side of Latin literature and found its models not in Virgil, Catullus, and Lucretius, but in the satires, epistles, and didactic pieces of Juvenal, Horace, and Persius. The chosen medium of the new poetry was the heroic couplet. This had, of course, been used before by English poets as far back as Chaucer. The greater part of the Canterbury Tales was written in heroic couplets. But now a new strength and precision were given to the familiar measure by imprisoning the sense within the limit of the couplet, and by treating each line as also a unit in itself. Edmund Waller had written verse of this kind as early as the reign of Charles I. "He," said Dryden, "first showed us to conclude the sense most commonly in distichs, which in the verse of those before him runs on for so many lines together that the reader is out of breath to overtake it." Sir John Denham, also, in his Cooper's Hill, 1643, had written such verse as this: "Oh, could I flow like thee and make thy stream my great example, as it is my theme. Though deep yet clear, though gentle yet not dull, strong without rage, without o'erflowing full." Here we have the regular flow and the nice balance between the first and second member of each couplet, and the first and second part of each line, which characterize the verse of Dryden and Pope. Waller was smooth, but Dryden taught us to join the varying verse, the full resounding line, the long resounding march and energy divine. Thus wrote Pope, using for the nonce the triplet and alexandrin, by which Dryden frequently varied the couplet. Pope himself added a greater neatness and polish to Dryden's verse, and brought the system to such monotonous perfection that he made poetry a mere mechanic art. The lyrical poetry of this generation was almost entirely worthless. The dissolute wits of Charles II's court, Sedley, Rochester, Sackville, and the mob of gentlemen who wrote with ease, threw off a few amatory trifles, but the age was not spontaneous or sincere enough for genuine song. Cowley introduced the Pindaric ode, a highly artificial form of the lyric, in which the language was tortured into a kind of spurious grandeur, and the meter teased into a sound and fury signifying nothing. Cowley's Pindarics were filled with something which passed for fire, but has now utterly gone out. Nevertheless, the fashion spread, and he who could do nothing else, said Dr. Johnson, could write like Pindar. The best of these odes was Dryden's famous Alexander's Feast, written for a celebration of St. Cecilia's Day by a musical club. To this same fashion also we owe Gray's two fine odes, The Progress of Poesy and The Bard, written a half century later. Dryden was not so much a great poet as a solid thinker, with a splendid mastery of expression, who used his energetic verse as a vehicle for political argument and satire. His first noteworthy poem, Annus Mirabilis, 1667, was a narrative of the public events of the year 1666, namely, the Dutch War and the Great Fire of London. The subject of Absalom and Ahitophel, the first part of which appeared in 1681, was the alleged plot of the Whig leader, the Earl of Shaftesbury, to defeat the succession of the Duke of York, afterward James II, by securing the throne to Monmouth, a natural son of Charles II. The parallel afforded by the story of Absalom's revolt against David was wrought out by Dryden with admirable ingenuity and keeping. He was at his best in satirical character sketches, such as the brilliant portraits in his poem of Shaftesbury as the false counselor Ahitophel, and of the Duke of Buckingham as Zimri. The latter was Dryden's reply to the rehearsal. Absalom and Ahitophel was followed by The Medal, a continuation of the same subject, and Mac Flecknoe, a personal onslaught on the true blue Protestant poet Thomas Shadwell, a political and literary foe of Dryden. Flecknoe, an obscure Irish poetaster, being about to retire from the throne of Dunstan, resolved to settle the succession upon his son Shadwell, whose claims to the inheritance are vigorously asserted. The rest to some faint meaning make pretense, but Shadwell never deviates into sense. The midwife laid her hand on his thick skull with this prophetic blessing, "Be thou dull." Dryden is our first great satirist. The formal satire had been written in the reign of Elizabeth by Donne, and by Joseph Hall, Bishop of Exeter, and subsequently by Marston, the dramatist, by Wither, Marvell, and others. But all of these failed through an overviolence of language and a purpose too pronouncedly moral. They had no lightness of touch, no irony and mischief. They bore down too hard, imitated Juvenal, and lashed English society in terms befitting the corruption of imperial Rome. They denounced, instructed, preached, did everything but satirize. The satirist must raise a laugh. Donne and Hall abused men in classes. Priests were worldly, lawyers greedy, courtiers obsequious, etc. But the easy scorn of Dryden and the delightful malice of Pope gave a pungent personal interest to their sarcasm, infinitely more effective than these commonplaces of satire. Dryden was as happy in controversy as in satire, and is unexcelled in the power to reason in verse. His Religio Laici, 1682, was a poem in defense of the English Church. But when James II came to the throne, Dryden turned Catholic, and wrote The Hind and Panther, 1687, to vindicate his new belief. Dryden had the misfortune to be dependent upon royal patronage and upon a corrupt stage. He sold his pen to the court, and in his comedies he was heavily and deliberately lewd, a sin which he afterward acknowledged and regretted. Milton's soul was like a star and dwelt apart, but Dryden wrote for the trampling multitude. He had a coarseness of moral fiber, but was not malignant in his satire, being of a large, careless, and forgetting nature. He had that masculine, enduring cast of mind which gathers heat and clearness from motion and grows better with age. His fables, modernizations from Chaucer and translations from Boccaccio, written the year before he died, are among his best works. Dryden is also our first critic of any importance. His critical essays were mostly written as prefaces or dedications to his poems and plays. But his essay on dramatic poesy, which Dr. Johnson called our first regular and valuable treatise on the art of writing, was in the shape of a Platonic dialogue. When not misled by the French classicism of his day, Dryden was an admirable critic, full of penetration and sound sense. He was the earliest writer, too, of modern literary prose. If the imitation of French models was an injury to poetry, it was a benefit to prose. The best modern prose is French, and it was the essayists of the Gallicized Restoration Age, Cowley, Sir William Temple, and above all Dryden, who gave modern English prose that simplicity, directness, and colloquial air which marks it off from the more artificial diction of Milton, Taylor, and Browne. A few books whose shaping influences lay in the past belong by their date to this period. John Bunyan, a poor tinker, whose reading was almost wholly in the Bible and Fox's Book of Martyrs, imprisoned for 12 years in Bedford jail for preaching at conventicles, wrote and in 1678 published his Pilgrim's Progress, the greatest of religious allegories. Bunyan's spiritual experiences were so real to him that they took visible, concrete shape in his imagination as men, women, cities, landscapes. It is the simplest, the most transparent of allegories. Unlike the Fairy Queen, the story of Pilgrim's Progress has no reason for existing apart from its inner meaning, and yet its reality is so vivid that children read of Vanity Fair and the Slough of Despond and Doubting Castle and the Valley of the Shadow of Death with the same belief with which they read of Crusoe's Cave or Aladdin's Palace. It is a long step from the Bedford tinker to the cultivated poet of Paradise Lost. They represent the poles of the Puritan party. Yet it may admit of a doubt whether the Puritan epic is, in essentials, as vital and original a work as the Puritan allegory. They both came out quietly and made little noise at first, but The Pilgrim's Progress got at once into circulation, and not even a single copy of the first edition remains. Milton, too, who received £10 for the copyright of Paradise Lost, seemingly found that fit audience though few, for which he prayed, as his poem reached its second impression in 5 years. Dryden visited him in his retirement and asked leave to turn it into rhyme and put it on the stage as an opera. "Aye," said Milton good-humoredly, "you may tag my verses." And accordingly they appeared, duly tagged, in Dryden's operatic mask, The State of Innocence. In this startling conjunction we have the two ages in a nutshell. The Commonwealth was an epic, the Restoration an opera. The literary period covered by the life of Pope, 1688 to 1744, is marked off by no distinct line from the generation before it. Taste continued to be governed by the precepts of Boileau and the French classical school. Poetry remained chiefly didactic and satirical, and satire in Pope's hands was more personal even than in Dryden's, and addressed itself less to public issues. The literature of the Augustan age of Queen Anne, 1702 to 1714, was still more a literature of the town and fashionable society than that of the Restoration had been. It was also closely involved with party struggles of Whig and Tory, and the ablest pens on either side were taken into alliance by the political leaders. Swift was in high favor with the Tory ministers, Oxford and Bolingbroke, and his pamphlets, The Public Spirit of the Whigs and The Conduct of the Allies, were rewarded with the deanery of St. Patrick's, Dublin. Addison became Secretary of State under a Whig government. Prior was in the diplomatic service. Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, 1719, was a prolific political writer, conducted his review in the interest of the Whigs, and was imprisoned and pilloried for his ironical pamphlet, The Shortest Way with the Dissenters. Steele, who was a violent writer on the Whig side, held various public offices such as Commissioner of Stamps and Commissioner for Forfeited Estates, and sat in Parliament. After the Revolution of 1688, the manners and morals of English society were somewhat on the mend. The court of William and Mary, and of their successor, Queen Anne, set no such example of open profligacy as that of Charles II. But there was much hard drinking, gambling, dueling, and intrigue in London, and vice was fashionable till Addison partly preached and partly laughed it down in the Spectator. The women were mostly frivolous and uneducated, and not unfrequently fast. They are spoken of with systematic disrespect by nearly every writer of the time, except Steele. "Every woman," wrote Pope, "is at heart a rake." The reading public had now become large enough to make letters a profession. Dr. Johnson said that Pope was the first writer in whose case the bookseller took the place of the patron. His translation of Homer, published by subscription, brought him between 8,000 and 9,000 pounds and made him independent. But the activity of the press produced a swarm of poorly paid hack writers, penny a liners, who lived from hand to mouth and did small literary jobs to order. Many of these inhabited Grub Street, and their lampoons against Pope and others of their more successful rivals called out Pope's Dunciad, or Epic of the Dunces, by way of retaliation. The politics of the time were sordid and consisted mainly of an ignoble scramble for office. The Whigs were fighting to maintain the Act of Succession in favor of the House of Hanover, and the Tories were secretly intriguing with the exiled Stuarts. Many of the leaders, such as the great Whig champion John Churchill, Duke of Marlborough, were without political principle or even personal honesty. The church, too, was in a condition of spiritual deadness. Bishoprics and livings were sold and given to political favorites. Clergymen, like Swift and Lawrence Sterne, were worldly in their lives and immoral in their writings, and were practically unbelievers. The growing religious skepticism appeared in the deist controversy. Numbers of men in high position were deists. The Earl of Shaftesbury, for example, and Pope's brilliant friend Henry St. John, Lord Bolingbroke, the head of the Tory ministry, whose political writings had much influence upon his young French acquaintance Voltaire. Pope was a Roman Catholic, though there is little to show it in his writings, and the underlying thought of his famous Essay on Man was furnished him by Bolingbroke. The letters of the cold-hearted Chesterfield to his son were accepted as a manual of conduct, and La Rochefoucauld's cynical maxims were quoted as authority on life and human nature. Said Swift, "As Rochefoucauld his maxims drew from nature, I believe them true. They argue no corrupted mind in him, the fault is in mankind." The succession which Dryden had willed to Congreve was taken up by Alexander Pope. He was a man quite unlike Dryden, sickly, deformed, morbidly precocious, and spiteful. Nevertheless, he joined on to and continued Dryden. He was more careful in his literary workmanship than his great forerunner, and in his moral essays and satires he brought the Horatian epistle in verse, the formal satire, and that species of didactic poem of which Boileau had given the first example, to an exquisite perfection of finish and verbal art. Dryden had translated Virgil, and so Pope translated Homer. The throne of the dunces which Dryden had conferred upon Shadwell, Pope, in his Dunciad, passed on to two of his own literary foes, Theobald and Colley Cibber. There is a great waste of strength in this elaborate squib, and most of the petty writers whose names it has preserved, as has been said, like flies in amber, are now quite unknown. But although we have to read it with notes to get the point of its allusions, it is easy to see what execution it must have done at the time, and it is impossible to withhold admiration from the wit, the wickedness, the triumphant mischief of the thing. The sketch of Addison, who had offended Pope by praising a rival translation of Homer, as Atticus, is as brilliant as anything of the kind in Dryden. Pope's very malignity made his sting sharper than Dryden's. He secreted venom, and worked out his revenges deliberately, bringing all the resources of his art to bear upon the question of how to give the most pain most cleverly. Pope's masterpiece is, perhaps, The Rape of the Lock, a mock heroic poem, a dwarf Iliad, recounting in five cantos a society quarrel, which arose from Lord Peter's cutting a lock of hair from the head of Mrs. Arabella Fermor. Boileau, in his Lutrin, had treated with the same epic dignity a dispute over the placing of the reading desk in a parish church. Pope was the Homer of the drawing room, the boudoir, the tea urn, the ombre party, the sedan chair, the parrot cage, and the lap dogs. This poem, in its sparkle and airy grace, is the topmost blossom of a highly artificial society, the quintessence of whatever poetry was possible in those teacup times of hood and hoop, and when the patch was worn, with whose decorative features, at least, the recent Queen Anne revival has made this generation familiar. It may be said of it, as Thackeray said of Gay's Pastorals, it is to poetry what charming little Dresden china figures are to sculpture, graceful, minikin, fantastic, with a certain beauty always accompanying them. The Rape of the Lock, perhaps, stops short of beauty, but it attains elegance and prettiness in a supreme degree. In imitation of the gods and goddesses in the Iliad who intermeddle for or against the human characters, Pope introduces the sylphs of the Rosicrucian philosophy. we may measure the distance between imagination and fancy if we will compare these little filigree creatures with Shakespeare's elves, whose occupation it was to tread the ooze of the salt deep, or run upon the sharp wind of the north, or on the beached margent of the sea, to dance their ringlets of the whispering wind. Very different were the offices of Pope's phase. Our humble province is to tend the fair, not a less pleasing, though less glorious care, to save the powder from too rude a gale, nor let the imprisoned essences exhale. Nay, oft in dream's invention we bestow to change a flounce or add a furbelow. Pope was not a great poet. It has been doubted whether he was a poet at all. He does not touch the heart or stimulate the imagination, as the true poet always does. In the poetry of nature and the poetry of passion, he was altogether impotent. His Windsor Forest and his pastorals are artificial and false, not written with the eye upon the object. His epistle of Eloisa to Abelard is declamatory and academic, and leaves the reader cold. The only one of his poems which is at all possessed with feeling is his pathetic Elegy to the Memory of an Unfortunate Lady. But he was a great literary artist. Within the cramped and starched regularity of the heroic couplet, which the fashion of the time and his own habit of mind imposed upon him, he secured the largest variety of modulation and emphasis of which that verse was capable. He used antithesis, periphrasis, and climax with great skill. His example dominated English poetry for nearly a century, and even now, when a poet like Dr. Holmes, for example, would write satire or humorous verse of a dignified kind, he turns instinctively to the measure and manner of Pope. He was not a consecutive thinker like Dryden, and cared less about the truth of his thought than about the pointedness of its expression. His language was closer grained than Dryden's. His great art was the art of putting things. He is more quoted than any other English poet but Shakespeare. He struck the average intelligence, the common sense of English readers, and furnished it with neat, portable formulas, so that it could no longer need to vent its observation in mangled terms, but could pour itself out compactly, artistically, in little ready-made molds. But his high-wrought brilliancy, this unceasing point, soon fatigue. His poems read like a series of epigrams, and every line has a hit or an effect. From the reign of Queen Anne date the beginnings of the periodical essay. Newspapers had been published since the time of the Civil War, at first irregularly and then regularly. But no literature of permanent value appeared in periodical form until Richard Steele started the Tatler in 1709. In this he was soon joined by his friend Joseph Addison, and in its successor the Spectator, the first number of which was issued March 1, 1711. Addison's contributions outnumbered Steele's. The Tatler was published on 3, the Spectator on 6 days of the week. The Tatler gave political news, but each number of the Spectator consisted of a single essay. The object of these periodicals was to reflect the passing humors of the time, and to satirize the follies and minor immoralities of the town. "I shall endeavor," wrote Addison in the 10th paper of the Spectator, "to enliven morality with wit, and to temper wit with morality." It was said of Socrates that he brought philosophy down from heaven to an abbot among men, and I shall be ambitious to have it said of me that I have brought philosophy out of the closets and libraries, schools and colleges, to dwell in clubs and assemblies, at tea tables and in coffee houses. Addison's satire was never personal. He was a moderate man and did what he could to restrain Steele's intemperate party zeal. His character was dignified and pure, and his strongest emotion seems to have been his religious feeling. One of his contemporaries called him a parson in a tie wig, and he wrote several excellent hymns. His mission was that of censor of the public taste. Sometimes he lectures, and sometimes he preaches, and in his Saturday papers he brought his wide reading and nice scholarship into service for the instruction of his readers. Such was the series of essays in which he gave an elaborate review of Paradise Lost. Such also was his famous paper, The Vision of Mirza, an Oriental allegory of human life. The adoption of this slight pedagogic tone was justified by the prevalent ignorance and frivolity of the age, but the lighter portions of the Spectator are those which have worn the best. Their style is at once correct and easy, and it is as a humorist, a sly observer of manners, and above all, a delightful talker, that Addison is best known to posterity. in the personal sketches of the members of the Spectator Club, of Will Honeycomb, Captain Sentry, Sir Andrew Freeport, and above all, Sir Roger de Coverley, the quaint and honest country gentleman, may be found the nucleus of the modern prose fiction of character. Addison's humor is always a trifle grave. There is no whimsy, no frolic in it, as in Sterne or Lamb. "He thinks justly," said Dr. Johnson, "but he thinks faintly." The Spectator had a host of followers, from the somewhat heavy Rambler and Idler of Johnson down to the Salmagundi papers of our own Irving, who was perhaps Addison's latest and best literary descendant. In his own age, Addison made some figure as a poet and dramatist. His campaign celebrating the victory of Blenheim had one much admired couplet in which Marlborough was likened to the angel of the tempest, who, "pleased the Almighty's orders to perform, rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm." His stately classical tragedy Cato, which was acted at Drury Lane Theater in 1712 with immense applause, was pronounced by Dr. Johnson unquestionably the noblest production of Addison's genius. It is, notwithstanding, cold and tedious as a whole, though it has some fine declamatory passages, in particular the soliloquy of Cato in the fifth act, "It must be so, Plato, thou reasonest well," etc. The greatest of the Queen Anne wits, and one of the most savage and powerful satirists that ever lived, was Jonathan Swift. As secretary in the family of Sir William Temple and domestic chaplain to the Earl of Berkeley, he had known in youth the bitterness of poverty and dependence. Afterward, he wrote himself into influence with the Tory ministry and was promised a bishopric, but was put off with the deanery of St. Patrick's and retired to Ireland to die like a poisoned rat in a hole. His life was made tragical by the forecast of the madness which finally overtook him. "The stage darkened," said Scott, "ere the curtain fell. Insanity deepened into idiocy and a hideous silence, and for 3 years before his death he spoke hardly ever a word." He had directed that his tombstone should bear the inscription, "Ubi saeva indignatio cor ulterius lacerare nequit." "So great a man he seems to me," wrote Thackeray, "that thinking of him is like thinking of an empire falling." Swift's first noteworthy publication was his Tale of a Tub, 1704, a satire on religious differences, but his great work was Gulliver's Travels, 1726, the book in which his hate and scorn of mankind and the long rage of mortified pride and thwarted ambition found their fullest expression. Children read the voyages to Lilliput and Brobdingnag, to the flying island of Laputa and the country of the Winhams, as they read Robinson Crusoe, as stories of wonderful adventure. Swift had all of Defoe's realism, his power of giving verisimilitude to his narrative by the invention of a vast number of small, exact, consistent details. But underneath its fairy tales, Gulliver's Travels is a satire, far more radical than any of Dryden's or Pope's, because directed not against particular parties or persons, but against human nature. In his account of Lilliput and Brobdingnag, Swift tries to show, looking first through one end of the telescope and then through the other, that human greatness, goodness, beauty disappear if the scale be altered a little. If men were 6 inches high instead of 6 feet, such is the logic of his tale, their wars, governments, science, religion, all their institutions, in fine, and all the courage, wisdom, and virtue by which these have been built up would appear laughable. On the other hand, if they were 60 feet high instead of 6, they would become disgusting. The complexion of the finest ladies would show blotches, hairs, excrescences, and an overpowering effluvium would breathe from the pores of the skin. Finally, in his loathsome caricature of mankind as yahoos, he contrasts them to their shame with the beasts, and sets instinct above reason. The method of Swift's satire was grave irony. Among his minor writings in this kind are his argument against abolishing Christianity, his modest proposal for utilizing the surplus population of Ireland by eating the babies of the poor, and his predictions of Isaac Bickerstaff. In the last, he predicted the death of one Partridge, an almanac maker, at a certain day and hour. When the time set was passed, he published a minute account of Partridge's last moments, and when the subject of this excellent fooling printed an indignant denial of his own death, Swift answered very temperately, proving that he was dead, and remonstrating him on the violence of his language. to call a man a fool and villain, an impudent fellow, only for differing from him in a point merely speculative, is, in my humble opinion, a very improper style for a person of his education. Swift wrote verses as well as prose, but their motive was the reverse of poetical. His gross and cynical humor vulgarized whatever it touched. He leaves us no illusions, and not only strips his subject, but flays it and shows the raw muscles beneath the skin. He delighted to dwell upon the lowest bodily functions of human nature. "He saw bloodshot," said Thackeray. End of Part 1, Chapter 5. Recording by Kalinda in Lüneburg, Germany, on February 17, 2009. Part 1, Chapter 6 of A Brief History of English and American Literature. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Kalinda. A Brief History of English and American Literature by Henry A. Beers. Part 1, Chapter 6. From the Death of Pope to the French Revolution, 1744 to 1789. Pope's example continued potent for 50 years after his death. Especially was this so in satiric and didactic poetry. Not only Dr. Johnson's adaptations from Juvenal, London, 1738, and The Vanity of Human Wishes, 1749, but Gifford's Baviad, 1791, and Maviad, 1795, and Byron's English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, 1809, were in the verse and manner of Pope. In Johnson's Lives of the Poets, 1781, Dryden and Pope are treated as the two greatest English poets. But long before this, a revolution in literary taste had begun, a movement which is variously described as the return to nature or the rise of the new romantic school. For nearly 100 years, poetry had dealt with manners and the life of towns, the gay, prosaic life of Congreve or of Pope. The sole concession to the life of nature was the old pastoral, which, in the hands of cockneys, like Pope and Ambrose Phillips, who merely repeated stock descriptions at second or third hand, became even more artificial than A Beggar's Opera or A Rape of the Lock. These, at least, were true to their environment and were natural just because they were artificial. But The Seasons of James Thompson, published in installments from 1726 to 30, had opened a new field. Their theme was the English landscape, as varied by the changes of the year, and they were written by a true lover and observer of nature. Mark Akenside's Pleasures of Imagination, 1744, published the year of Pope's death, was written like The Seasons in blank verse, and although its language had much of the formal didactic cast of the Queen Anne poets, it pointed unmistakably in the new direction. Thompson had painted the soft beauties of a highly cultivated land, lawns, gardens, forest preserves, orchards, and sheep walks. But now a fresh note was struck in the literature, not of England alone, but of Germany and France. Romanticism, the chief element in which was a love of the wild. Poets turned from the lameness of modern existence to savage nature and the heroic simplicity of life among primitive tribes. In France, Rousseau introduced the idea of the natural man, following his instincts in disregard of social conventions. In Germany, Bodmer published, in 1753, the first edition of the old German epic, the Nibelungenlied. Works of a similar tendency in England were the odes of William Collins and Thomas Gray, published between 1747 and 57, especially Collins's Ode on the Superstitions of the Highlands and Gray's Bard, a Pindaric, in which the last survivor of the Welsh bards invokes vengeance on Edward I, the destroyer of his guild. Gray and Mason, his friend and editor, made translations from the ancient Welsh and Norse poetry. Thomas Percy's Relics of Ancient English Poetry, 1765, aroused a taste for old ballads. Richard Hurd's Letters on Chivalry and Romance, Thomas Warton's History of English Poetry, 1774-78, Tyrwhitt's critical edition of Chaucer, and Horace Walpole's Gothic romance The Castle of Otranto, 1765, stimulated this awakened interest in the picturesque aspects of feudal life and contributed to the fondness for supernatural and medieval subjects. James Beattie's Minstrel, 1771, described the educating influence of Scottish mountain scenery upon the genius of a young poet. But the most remarkable instances of this passion for wild nature and the romantic past were the poems of Ossian and Thomas Chatterton's literary forgeries. In 1762, James Macpherson published the first installment of what professed to be a translation of the poems of Ossian, a Gaelic bard, whom tradition placed in the 3rd century. Macpherson said that he had made his version, including 2 complete epics, Fingal and Tamora, from Gaelic manuscripts, which he had collected in the Scottish Highlands. A fierce controversy at once sprang up over the genuineness of these remains. Macpherson was challenged to produce his originals, and when, many years after, he published the Gaelic text, it was asserted that this was nothing but a translation of his own English into modern Gaelic. Of the manuscripts which he had professed to have found, not a scrap remained. The Gaelic text was printed from transcriptions in Macpherson's handwriting or in that of his secretaries. But whether these poems were the work of Ossian or of Macpherson, they made a deep impression upon the time. Napoleon admired them greatly, and Goethe inserted passages from the Songs of Selma in his Sorrows of Werther. Macpherson composed or translated them in an abrupt, rhapsodical prose, resembling the English version of Job or of the prophecies of Isaiah. They filled the minds of their readers with images of vague sublimity and desolation, the mountain torrent, the mist on the hills, the ghosts of heroes half seen by the setting moon, the thistle in the ruined courts of chieftains, the grass whistling on the windy heath, the grey rock by the blue stream of Lutha, and the cliffs of sea-surrounded Gormal. A tale of the times of old. Why, thou wanderer unseen, thou bender of the thistle of Laura, why, thou breeze of the valley, hast thou left mine ear? I hear no distant roar of streams, no sound of the harp from the rock. Come, thou huntress of Lutha, Malvina, call back his soul to the bard. I look forward to Lochlin of Lakes, to the dark billowy bay of Uthorno, where Fingal descends from ocean from the roar of winds. Few are the heroes of Morven in a land unknown. Thomas Chatterton, who died by his own hand in 1770 at the age of 17, is one of the most wonderful examples of precocity in the history of literature. His father had been sexton of the ancient church of St. Mary Redcliffe in Bristol, and the boy's sensitive imagination took the stamp of its surroundings. He taught himself to read from a black-letter Bible. He drew charcoal sketches of churches, castles, knightly tombs, and heraldic blazonry. When only 11 years old, he began the fabrication of documents in prose and verse, which he ascribed to a fictitious Thomas Rowley, a secular priest at Bristol in the 15th century. Chatterton pretended to have found these among the contents of an old chest in the muniment room of St. Mary Redcliffe's. The Rowley poems included 2 tragedies, Aella and Godwin, 2 cantos of a long poem on the Battle of Hastings, and a number of ballads and minor pieces. Chatterton had no precise knowledge of early English or even of Chaucer. His method of working was as follows. He made himself a manuscript glossary of the words marked as archaic in Bailey's and Kersey's English dictionaries, composed his poems first in modern language, and then turned them into ancient spelling, and substituted here and there the old words in his glossary for their modern equivalents. Naturally, he made many mistakes, and though Horace Walpole, to whom he sent some of his pieces, was unable to detect the forgery, his friends Gray and Mason, to whom he submitted them, at once pronounced them spurious. Nevertheless, there was a controversy over Rowley, hardly less obstinate than that over Ossian, a controversy made possible only by the then almost universal ignorance of the forms, scansion, and vocabulary of early English poetry. Chatterton's poems are of little value in themselves, but they are the record of an industry and imitative quickness, marvelous in a mere child, and they show how, with the instinct of genius, he threw himself into the main literary current of his time. Discarding the couplet of Pope, the poets now went back for models to the Elizabethan writers. Thomas Warton published in 1753 his Observations on the Faerie Queen. Beattie's Minstrel, Thomson's Castle of Indolence, William Shenstone's Schoolmistress, and John Dyer's Fleece were all written in the Spenserian stanza. Shenstone gave a partly humorous effect to his poem by imitating Spenser's archaisms, and Thomson reproduced in many passages the copious harmony and luxuriant imagery of the Faerie Queen. The Fleece was a poem on English wool growing, after the fashion of Virgil's Georgics. The subject was unfortunate, for, as Dr. Johnson said, it is impossible to make poetry out of serges and druggets. Dyer's Gronger Hill, which mingles reflection with natural description in the manner of Gray's Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard, was composed in the octosyllabic verse of Milton's L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. Milton's minor poems, which had hitherto been neglected, exercised a great influence on Collins and Gray. Collins's Ode to Simplicity was written in the stanza of Milton's Nativity, and his exquisite, unrhymed Ode to Evening was a study in versification after Milton's translation of Horace's Ode to Pyrrha in the original meters. Shakespeare began to be studied more reverently. Numerous critical editions of his plays were issued, and Garrick restored his pure text to the stage. Collins was an enthusiastic student of Shakespeare, and one of his sweetest poems, The Dirge in Cymbeline, was inspired by the tragedy of Cymbeline. The verse of Gray, Collins, and the Wharton brothers abounds in verbal reminiscences of Shakespeare, but their genius was not allied to his, being exclusively lyrical and not at all dramatic. The muse of this romantic school was fancy rather than passion. A thoughtful melancholy, a gentle scholarly pensiveness, the spirit of Milton's Il Penseroso, pervades their poetry. Gray was a fastidious scholar who produced very little, but that little of the finest quality. His famous Elegy, expressing a meditative mood in language of the choicest perfection, is the representative poem of the second half of the 18th century, as The Rape of the Lock is of the first. The Romanticists were quietists, and their scenery is characteristic. They loved solitude and evening, the twilight vale, the mossy hermitage, ruins, glens, and caves. Their style was elegant and academic, retaining a little of the stilted poetic diction of their classical forerunners. Personification and periphrasis were their favorite mannerisms. Collins's odes were largely addressed to abstractions, such as fear, pity, liberty, mercy, and simplicity. A poet in their dialect was always a bard, a countryman was the untutored swain, and a woman was a nymph, or the fair, just as in Dryden and Pope. Thomson is perpetually mindful of Virgil, and afraid to speak simply. He uses too many Latin epithets, like amusive and precipitant, and calls a fish line the floating line snatched from the hoary steed. They left much for Cowper and Wordsworth to do in the way of infusing the new blood of a strong, racy English into our exhausted poetic diction. Their poetry is impersonal, bookish, literary. It lacks emotional force, except now and then in Gray's immortal Elegy, in his Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College, in Collins's lines on the death of Thomson, and his little ode beginning, How Sleep the Brave. The new school did not lack critical expounders of its principles and practice. Joseph Wharton published in 1756 the first volume of his Essay on the Genius and Writings of Pope, an elaborate review of Pope's writings, seriatim, doing him certainly full justice, but ranking him below Shakespeare, Spenser, and Milton. Wit and satire, wrote Wharton, are transitory and perishable, but nature and passion are eternal. He stuck to describing modern manners, but those manners, because they are familiar, artificial, and polished, are in their very nature unfit for any lofty effort of the muse. Whatever poetical enthusiasm he actually possessed, he withheld and stifled. Surely it is no narrow and niggardly encomium to say he is the great poet of reason, the first of ethical authors in verse. Wharton illustrated his critical positions by quoting freely not only from Spenser and Milton, but from recent poets like Thomson, Gray, Collins, and Dyer. He testified that the Seasons had been very instrumental in diffusing a general taste for the beauties of nature and landscape. It was symptomatic of the change in literary taste that the natural or English school of landscape gardening now began to displace the French and Dutch fashion of clipped hedges, regular parterres, etc., and that Gothic architecture came into repute. Horace Walpole was a virtuoso in Gothic art, and in his castle at Strawberry Hill, he made a collection of ancient armor, illuminated manuscripts, and bric-a-brac of all kinds. Gray had been Walpole's traveling companion in France and Italy, and the two had quarreled and separated, but were afterward reconciled. From Walpole's private printing press at Strawberry Hill, Gray's two sister odes, The Bard and The Progress of Poesy, were first printed in 1757. Both Gray and Walpole were good correspondents, and their printed letters are among the most delightful literature of the kind. The central figure among the English men of letters of that generation was Samuel Johnson, 1709-84, whose memory has been preserved less by his own writings than by James Boswell's famous Life of Johnson, published in 1791. Boswell was a Scotch laird and advocate, who first met Johnson in London, when the latter was 54 years old. Boswell was not a very wise or witty person, but he reverenced the worth and intellect which shone through his subject's uncouth exterior. He followed him about, notebook in hand, bore all his snubbings patiently, and made the best biography ever written. It is related that the doctor once said that if he thought Boswell meant to write his life, he should prevent it by taking Boswell's. And yet Johnson's own writings and this biography of him have changed places in relative importance so completely that Carlyle predicted that the former would soon be reduced to notes on the latter, and Macaulay said that the man who was known to his contemporaries as a great writer was known to posterity as an agreeable companion. Johnson was one of those rugged, eccentric, self-developed characters so common among the English. He was the son of a Lichfield bookseller, and after a course at Oxford, which was cut short by poverty, and an unsuccessful career as a schoolmaster, he had come up to London in 1737, where he supported himself for many years as a bookseller's hack. Gradually, his great learning and abilities, his ready social wit and powers as a talker, caused his company to be sought at the tables of those whom he called the great. He was a clubbable man, and he drew about him at the tavern a group of the most distinguished intellects of the time: Edmund Burke, the orator and statesman, Oliver Goldsmith, Sir Joshua Reynolds, the portrait painter, and David Garrick, the great actor, who had been a pupil in Johnson's school near Lichfield. Johnson was the typical John Bull of the last century. His oddities, virtues, and prejudices were thoroughly English. He hated Frenchmen, Scotchmen, and Americans, and had a cockneyish attachment to London. He was a high Tory and an orthodox churchman. He loved a lord in the abstract, and yet he asserted sturdy independence against any lord in particular. He was deeply religious, but had an abiding fear of death. He was burly in person and slovenly in dress, his shirt frill always covered with snuff. He was a great diner out, an inordinate tea drinker, and a voracious and untidy feeder. An inherited scrofula, which often took the form of hypochondria and threatened to affect his brain, deprived him of control over the muscles of his face. Boswell describes how his features worked, how he snorted, grunted, whistled, and rolled about in his chair when getting ready to speak. He records his minutest traits, such as his habit of pocketing the orange peels at the club, and his superstitious way of touching all the posts between his house and the Mitre Tavern, going back to do it if he skipped one by chance. Though bearish in his manners and arrogant in dispute, especially when talking for victory, Johnson had a large and tender heart. He loved his ugly old wife, 21 years his senior, and he had his house full of unfortunates: a blind woman, an invalid surgeon, a destitute widow, a negro servant, whom he supported for many years and bore with all their ill humors patiently. Among Johnson's numerous writings, the ones best entitled to remembrance are, perhaps, his Dictionary of the English Language, 1755, his moral tale Rasselas, 1759, the introduction to his edition of Shakespeare, 1765, and his Lives of the Poets, 1781. Johnson wrote a sonorous, cadenced prose, full of big Latin words and balanced clauses. Here is a sentence, for example, from his Visit to the Hebrides: "We were now treading that illustrious island which was once the luminary of the Caledonian regions, whence savage clans and roving barbarians derived the benefits of knowledge and the blessings of religion. To abstract the mind from all local emotion would be impossible, if it were endeavored, and would be foolish if it were possible." The difference between his colloquial style and his book style is well illustrated in the instance cited by Macaulay. Speaking of Villiers' rehearsal, Johnson said, "It has not wit enough to keep it sweet," then paused and added, translating English into Johnsonese, "It has not vitality sufficient to preserve it from putrefaction." There is more of this in Johnson's Rambler and Idler papers than in his latest work, The Lives of the Poets. In this he showed himself a sound and judicious critic, though with decided limitations. His understanding was solid, but he was a thorough classicist, and his taste in poetry was formed on Pope. He was unjust to Milton and to his own contemporaries, Gray, Collins, Shenstone, and Dyer. He had no sense of the higher and subtler graces of romantic poetry, and he had a comical indifference to the beauties of nature. When Boswell once ventured to remark that poor Scotland had, at least, some noble wild prospects, the doctor replied that the noblest prospect a Scotchman ever saw was the road that led to London. The English novel of real life had its origin at this time. Books like Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, Captain Singleton, Journal of the Plague, etc., were tales of incident and adventure rather than novels. The novel deals primarily with character and with the interaction of characters upon one another, as developed by a regular plot. The first English novelist, in the modern sense of the word, was Samuel Richardson, a printer, who began authorship in his 50th year with his Pamela, the story of a young servant girl who resisted the seductions of her master and finally, as the reward of her virtue, became his wife. Clarissa Harlowe, 1748, was the tragical history of a high-spirited young lady who, being driven from home by her family, because she refused to marry the suitor selected for her, fell into the toils of Lovelace, an accomplished rake. After struggling heroically against every form of artifice and violence, she was at last drugged and ruined. She died of a broken heart, and Lovelace, borne down by remorse, was killed in a duel by a cousin of Clarissa. Sir Charles Grandison, 1753, was Richardson's portrait of an ideal, fine gentleman, whose stately doings fill 8 volumes, but who seems to the modern reader a bore and a prig. All of these novels were written in the form of letters passing between the characters, a method which fitted Richardson's subjective cast of mind. He knew little of life, but he identified himself intensely with his principal character and produced a strong effect by minute, accumulated touches. Clarissa Harlowe is his masterpiece, though even in that the situation is painfully prolonged, the heroine's virtue is self-conscious and rhetorical, and there is something almost ludicrously unnatural in the copiousness with which she pours herself out in gushing epistles to her female correspondent at the very moment when she is beset with dangers, persecuted, agonized, and driven nearly mad. In Richardson's novels appears, for the first time, that sentimentalism which now began to infect European literature. Pamela was translated into French and German, and fell in with that current of popular feeling which found fullest expression in Rousseau's Nouvelle Héloïse, 1759, and Goethe's Leiden des jungen Werther, which set all the world a-weeping in 1774. Coleridge said that to pass from Richardson's books to those of Henry Fielding was like going into the fresh air from a close room heated by stoves. Richardson, it has been affirmed, knew man, but Fielding knew men. The latter's first novel, Joseph Andrews, 1742, was begun as a travesty of Pamela. The hero, a brother of Pamela, was a young footman in the employ of Lady Booby, from whom his virtue suffered a like assault to that made upon Pamela's by her master. This reversal of the natural situation was in itself full of laughable possibilities, had the book gone on simply as a burlesque. But the exuberance of Fielding's genius led him beyond his original design. This hero, leaving Lady Booby's service, goes traveling with good Parson Adams and is soon engaged in a series of comical and rather boisterous adventures. Fielding had seen life, and his characters were painted from the life with a bold, free hand. He was a gentleman by birth and had made acquaintance with society in the town in 1727, when he was a handsome, stalwart young fellow, with high animal spirits and a great appetite for pleasure. He soon ran himself into debt and began writing for the stage, married and spent his wife's fortune, living for a while in much splendor as a country gentleman, and afterward in a reduced condition as a rural justice with a salary of £500 of the dirtiest money on earth. Fielding's masterpiece was Tom Jones, 1749, and it remains one of the best of English novels. Its hero is very much after Fielding's own heart, wild, spendthrift, warm-hearted, forgiving, and greatly in need of forgiveness. The same type of character with the lines deepened reappears in Captain Booth, in Amelia, 1751, the heroine of which is a portrait of Fielding's wife. With Tom Jones is contrasted Blifil, the embodiment of meanness, hypocrisy, and cowardice. Sophia Western, the heroine, is one of the Fielding's most admirable creations. For the regulated morality of Richardson, with its somewhat old, granified air, Fielding substituted instinct. his virtuous characters are virtuous by impulse only, and his ideal of character is manliness. In Jonathan Wild, the hero is a highwayman. This novel is ironical, a sort of prose mock heroic, and is one of the strongest, though certainly the least pleasing, of Fielding's writings. Tobias Smollett was an inferior Fielding with a difference. He was a Scotch ship surgeon and had spent some time in the West Indies. He introduced into fiction the now familiar figure of the British tar in the persons of Tom Bowling and Commodore Trunnion, as Fielding had introduced in Squire Western the equally national type of hard-swearing, deep-drinking, fox-hunting Tory squire. Both Fielding and Smollett were of the hearty British beef-and-beer school. Their novels are downright, energetic, coarse, and high-blooded. Low-life, physical life runs riot through their pages. Tavern brawls, the breaking of pates, and the offhand courtship of country wenches. Smollett's books, such as Roderick Random, 1748, Peregrine Pickle, 1751, and Ferdinand Count Fathom, 1752, were more purely stories of broadly comic adventure than Fielding's. The latter's view of life was by no means idyllic, but with Smollett, this English realism ran into vulgarity and a hard Scotch literalness, and character was pushed to caricature. "The generous wine of Fielding," says Taine, "in Smollett's hands becomes brandy of the dram shop." A partial exception to this is to be found in his last and best novel, Humphrey Clinker, 1770. The influence of Cervantes and of the French novelist Le Sage, who finished his Adventures of Gil Blas in 1735, are very perceptible in Smollett. A genius of much finer mold was Lawrence Sterne, the author of Tristram Shandy, 1759-67, and The Sentimental Journey, 1768. Tristram Shandy is hardly a novel. The story merely serves to hold together a number of characters, such as Uncle Toby and Corporal Trim, conceived with rare subtlety and originality. Sterne's chosen province was the whimsical, and his great model was Rabelais. His books are full of digressions, breaks, surprises, innuendos, double meanings, mystifications, and all manner of odd turns. Coleridge and Carlyle unite in pronouncing him a great humorist. Thackeray says that he was only a great jester. Humor is the laughter of the heart, and Sterne's pathos is closely interwoven with his humor. He was the foremost of English sentimentalists, and he had that taint of insincerity which distinguishes sentimentalism from genuine sentiment, like Goldsmith's, for example. Sterne, in life, was selfish, heartless, and untrue. A clergyman, his worldliness and vanity and the indecency of his writings were a scandal to the church, though his sermons were both witty and affecting. He enjoyed the titillation of his own emotions, and he had practiced so long at detecting the latent pathos that lies in the expression of dumb things and of poor patient animals, that he could summon the tear of sensibility at the thought of a discarded postchaise, a dead donkey, a starling in a cage, or of Uncle Toby putting a housefly out of the window and saying, "There is room enough in the world for thee and me." It is a high proof of his cleverness that he generally succeeds in raising the desired feelings in his reader, even from such trivial occasions. He was a minute philosopher, his philosophy was kindly, and he taught the delicate art of making much out of little. Less coarse than Fielding, he is far more corrupt. Fielding goes bluntly to the point. Sterne lingers among the temptations and suspends the expectation to tease and excite it. Forbidden fruit had a relish for him, and his pages seduce. He is full of good sayings, both tender and witty. It was Sterne, for example, who wrote, "God tempers the wind to the shorn lamb." A very different writer was Oliver Goldsmith, whose Vicar of Wakefield, 1766, was the earliest and is still one of the best novels of domestic and rural life. The book, like its author, was thoroughly Irish, full of bulls and inconsistencies. Very improbable things happen in it with a cheerful defiance of logic, but its characters are true to nature, drawn with an idyllic sweetness and purity, and with touches of a most loving humor. Its hero, Dr. Primrose, was painted after Goldsmith's father, a poor clergyman of the English church in Ireland, and the original, likewise, of the country parson in Goldsmith's deserted village, 1770, who was passing rich on £40 a year. This poem, though written in the fashionable couplet of Pope, and even containing a few verses contributed by Dr. Johnson, so that it was not at all in line with the work of the Romanticists, did perhaps as much as anything of Gray or of Collins to recall English poetry to the simplicity and freshness of country life. Except for the comedies of Sheridan and Goldsmith, and perhaps a few other plays, the stage had now utterly declined. The novel, which is dramatic in essence, though not in form, began to take its place, and to represent life, though less intensely, yet more minutely than the theater could do. In the novelists of the 18th century, the life of the people, as distinguished from society or the upper classes, began to invade literature. Richardson was distinctly a bourgeois writer, and his contemporaries, Fielding, Smollett, Sterne, and Goldsmith, ranged over a wide variety of ranks and conditions. This is one thing which distinguishes the literature of the second half of the 18th century from that of the first, as well as in some degree from that of all previous centuries. Among the authors of this generation whose writings belong to other departments of thought than pure literature may be mentioned in passing the great historian Edward Gibbon, whose Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was published from 1776 to 88, and Edmund Burke, whose political speeches and pamphlets possess a true literary quality. The Romantic poets had addressed the imagination rather than the heart. It was reserved for two men, a contrast to one another in almost every respect, to bring once more into British song a strong, individual feeling, and with it a new warmth and directness of speech. These were William Cowper, 1731 to 1800, and Robert Burns, 1759 to 96. Cowper spoke out of his own life experience, his agony, his love, his worship and despair, and straight away the varnish that had glittered all over our poetry since the time of Dryden melted away. Cowper had scribbled verses when he was a young law student at the Middle Temple in London, and he had contributed to the Only Hymns, published in 1779 by his friend and pastor, the Reverend John Newton. But he only began to write poetry in earnest when he was nearly 50 years old. In 1782, the date of his first volume, he said in a letter to a friend that he had read but one English poet during the past 20 years. Perhaps, therefore, of all English poets of equal culture, Cowper owed the least impulse to books and the most to need of uttering his inmost thoughts and feelings. Cowper had a most unhappy life. As a child, he was shy, sensitive, and sickly, and suffered much from bullying and fagging at a school whither he was sent after his mother's death. This happened when he was 6 years old, and in his affecting lines written on receipt of my mother's picture, he speaks of himself as a wretch even then, life's journey just begun. In 1763 he became insane and was sent to an asylum, where he spent a year. Judicious treatment restored him to sanity, but he came out a broken man, and remained for the rest of his life an invalid, unfitted for any active occupation. His disease took the form of religious melancholy. He had two recurrences of madness, and both times made attempts on his life. At Huntingdon, and afterward at Olney, in Buckinghamshire, he found a home with the Unwin family, whose kindness did all which the most soothing and delicate care could do to heal his wounded spirit. His two poems, To Mary Unwin, together with the lines on his mother's picture, were almost the first examples of deep and tender sentiment in the lyrical poetry of the last century. Cowper found relief from the black thoughts that beset him only in an ordered round of quiet household occupations. He corresponded indefatigably, took long walks through the neighborhood, read, sang, and conversed with Mrs. Unwin and his friend Lady Austen, and amused himself with carpentry, gardening, and raising pets, especially hares, of which gentle animals he grew very fond. All these simple tastes, in which he found for a time a refuge and a sheltered happiness, are reflected in his best poem, The Task, 1785. Cowper is the poet of the family affections, of domestic life, and rural retirement. The laureate of the fireside, the tea table, the evening lamp, the garden, the greenhouse, and the rabbit coop. He draws with elegance and precision a chair, a clock, a harpsichord, a barometer, a piece of needlework. But Cowper was an outdoor as well as an indoor man. The only landscape was tame, a fat agricultural region, where the sluggish ows wound between plowed fields and the horizon was bounded by low hills. Nevertheless, Cowper's natural descriptions are at once more distinct and more imaginative than Thomson's. The Task reflects also the new philanthropic spirit, the enthusiasm of humanity, the feeling of the brotherhood of men to which Rousseau had given expression in France, and which issued in the French Revolution. In England this was the time of Wilberforce, the anti-slavery agitator, of Whitefield, the eloquent revival preacher, of John and Charles Wesley, and of the evangelical and Methodist movements which gave new life to the English church. John Newton, the curate of Olney, and the keeper of Cowper's conscience, was one of the leaders of the evangelicals, and Cowper's first volume of Table Talk and Other Poems, 1782, written under Newton's inspiration, was a series of sermons in verse, somewhat intolerant of all worldly enjoyments such as hunting, dancing, and theaters. "God made the country and man made the town," he wrote. He was a moralizing poet, and his morality was sometimes that of the invalid and the recluse. Byron called him a coddled poet, and indeed there is a suspicion of gruel and dressing gowns about him. He lived much among women, and his sufferings had refined him to a feminine delicacy. But there is no sickliness in his poetry, and he retained a charming, playful humor displayed in his excellent comic ballad, John Gilpin. And Mrs. Browning has sung of him, "How, when one by one sweet sounds and wandering lights departed, he bore no less a loving face, because so broken-hearted." At the close of the year 1786, a young Scotchman named Samuel Rose called upon Cowper at Olney, and left with him a small volume, which had appeared at Edinburgh during the past summer, entitled Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect by Robert Burns. Cowper read the book through twice, and though somewhat bothered by the dialect, pronounced it a very extraordinary production. This momentary flash, as of an electric spark, marks the contact not only of the two chief British poets of their generation, but of two literatures. Scotch poets, like Thomson and Beattie, had written in Southern English, and as Carlyle said, in vacuo, that is, with nothing specially national in their work. Burns's sweet, though rugged, Doric first secured the vernacular poetry of his country a hearing beyond the border. He had, to be sure, a whole literature of popular songs and ballads behind him, and his immediate models were Allan Ramsay and Robert Ferguson, but these remained provincial, while Burns became universal. He was born in Ayrshire, on the banks of Bonny Doon, in a clay biggin not far from Alloway's old haunted kirk, the scene of the witch dance in Tam O'Shanter. His father was a hard-headed, God-fearing tenant farmer, whose life and that of his sons was a harsh struggle with poverty. The crops failed, the landlord pressed for his rent. For weeks at a time the family tasted no meat. Yet this life of toil was lightened by love and homely pleasures. In The Cotter's Saturday Night, Burns has drawn a beautiful picture of his parents' household, the rest that came at the week's end, and the family worship about the wee bit ingle blinkin' bonnily. Robert was handsome, wild, and witty. He was universally susceptible, and his first songs, like his last, were of the lasses. His head had been stuffed in boyhood with tales and songs concerning devils, ghosts, fairies, brownies, witches, warlocks, spunkies, kelpies, elf candles, deadlights, etc., told him by one Jenny Wilson, an old woman who lived in the family. His ear was full of ancient Scottish tunes, and as soon as he fell in love, he began to make poetry as naturally as a bird sings. He composed his verses while following the plough or working in the stackyard, or at evening, balancing on two legs of his chair and watching the light of a peat fire play over the reeky walls of the cottage. Burns's love songs are in many keys, ranging from strains of the most pure and exalted passions, like A Fond Kiss and To Marry in Heaven, to such loose ditties as When January Winds and Green Grow the Rushes-O. Burns liked a glass almost as well as a lass, and at Mauchline, where he carried on a farm with his brother Gilbert after their father's death, he began to seek a questionable relief from the pressure of daily toil and unkind fates in the convivialities of the tavern. There, among the wits of the Mauchline Club, farmers' sons, shepherds from the uplands, and the smugglers who swarmed over the west coast, he would discuss politics and farming, recite his verses, and join in the singing and ranting, while boozin' o'er the nappy and gettin' fou and unco happy. To these experiences we owe not only those excellent drinking songs, John Barleycorn and Willie Brew to Peck 'em Out, but the headlong fun of Tam O'Shanter and the visions, grotesquely terrible, of Death and Dr. Hornbrook, and the dramatic humor of the Jolly Beggars. Cowper had celebrated the cup which cheers but not inebriates, Burns sang the praises of the Scotch drink. Cowper was a stranger to Burns' high animal spirits and his robust enjoyment of life. He had affections, but no passions. At Mauchline, Burns, whose irregularities did not escape the censure of the Kirk, became involved, through his friendship with Gavin Hamilton, in the controversy between the Old Light and New Light clergy. His Holy Fair, Holy Tulsey, Two Herds, Holy Willie's Prayer, and Address to the Unco Gude are satires against bigotry and hypocrisy. But in spite of the rollicking profanity of his language and the violence of his rebound against the austere religion of Scotland, Burns was at bottom deeply impressible by religious ideas, as may be seen from his Prayer Under the Pressure of Violent Anguish and Prayer in Prospect of Death. His farm turned out a failure, and he was on the eve of sailing for Jamaica when the favor with which his volume of poems was received stayed his departure and turned his steps to Edinburgh. There, the peasant poet was lionized for a winter season by the learned and polite society of the Scotch capital, with results in the end not altogether favorable to Burns' best interests. For when society finally turned the cold shoulder on him, he had to go back to farming again, carrying with him a bitter sense of injustice and neglect. He leased a farm in Ellisland in 1788, and some friends procured his appointment as exciseman for the district. But poverty, disappointment, irregular habits, and broken health clouded his last years, and brought him an untimely death at the age of 37. He continued, however, to pour forth songs of unequaled sweetness and force. "The man sank," said Coleridge, "but the poet was bright to the last." Burns is the best of British songwriters. His songs are singable, they are not merely lyrical poems. They were meant to be sung, and they are sung. They were mostly set to old Scottish airs, and sometimes they were built up from ancient fragments of anonymous popular poetry, a chorus or stanza, or even a single line. Such are, for example, "Auld Lang Syne," "My Heart's in the Highlands," and "Landlady Count the Lawin." Burns had a great warm heart. His sins were sins of passion, and sprang from the same generous soil that nourished his impulsive virtues. His elementary qualities as a poet were sincerity, a healthy openness to all impressions of the beautiful, and a sympathy which embraced men, animals, and the dumb objects of nature. His tenderness toward flowers and the brute creation may be read in his lines "To a Mountain Daisy," "To a Mouse," and the old farmer's New Year's morning salutation to his old mare Maggie. Next after love and good fellowship, patriotism is the most frequent motive of his song. Of his national anthem, "Scots, what ha' ye Wallace bled?" Carlyle said, "So long as there is warm blood in the heart of a Scotchman, or man, it will move in fierce thrills under this war ode." Burns's politics were a singular mixture of sentimental Toryism with practical democracy. A romantic glamour was thrown over the fortunes of the exiled Stuarts, and to have been out in 45 with the young Pretender was a popular thing in parts of Scotland. To this purely poetic loyalty may be attributed such Jacobite ballads of Burns as "Over the Water to Charlie." But his sober convictions were on the side of liberty and human brotherhood, and are expressed in the "Twa Dogs," the "First Epistle to Davy," and "A Man's a Man for a' that." His sympathy with the Revolution led him to send 4 pieces of ordnance taken from a captured smuggler as a present to the French Convention, a piece of bravado which got him into difficulties with his superiors in the excise. The poetry which Burns wrote, not in dialect, but in the classical English, is in the stilted manner of his century, and his prose correspondence betrays his lack of culture by his constant lapse into rhetorical affectation and fine writing. End of Part 1, Chapter 6.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.